Hey, welcome to Talk the Talk. This is Fernando with episode 2. I wanted to talk about time restraints in movies and how outrageous they are compared to like real life comparison. Like, I understand that it's something that's, you know, for a lot of suspense, but like telling me that you have 10 minutes to disarm a bomb and it gets you 30 minutes to get to the top of the building and find the bomb, you still have 3 minutes left to disarm that bomb after it's been 31 minutes. I don't know. It's just, the illusion is kind of broken for me at that point. It's like when somebody goes underwater in a movie and you try and hold your breath for as long as the actor's holding their breath. The moment you start turning purple and you like let your breath out, they're like, they should be dead. I know they should be dead. Or at least passed out right now. Because I'd be passed out right now. The illusion's kind of broken, you know? And I know that's, like, kind of nitpicky, but I was thinking about the Transformers movies, to be honest, and, like, the fourth one, specifically, and, like, they end up in this spaceship, like, this massive city-size spaceship, and this, like, 16, 17-year-old girl is at one point dropped from one of the Decepticon, the bad guy creatures, onto the ship somehow, and she escapes from them. And she has to run around the ship and get either rescued or get to a certain room, something like that, so that she can get off of the ship. And, like I said, this thing's this, like the size of a city. So I can barely make it on time to an appointment. Like, if I'm going to a building in the middle of downtown, like, driving there, getting there 10 minutes early, if I'm in front of the building 10 minutes early, I still have to rush to the certain floor, make sure that I'm, like, there within a certain time period, that I'm not sweating, like, I'm able to actually walk in there, you know what I mean? So, being able to run across an entire city-wide space battleship, it's just, kind of breaks the illusion for me. And I'm like, yeah, we have CG, yeah, we can make things that are grandiose and massive, but just remember to write within the size of your character's distance. Like, it makes me think about Game of Thrones. You know, we had entire seasons where characters would travel from one destination to another. I mean, if you look at Arya's arc in the first two seasons of the show, first, I believe, 2.5 books of the book series, Arya is just traveling to go find her family in Westeros, and eventually it proves for naught, and she has to find other things to search for, and she ends up traveling across the sea, which then also takes her, like, another half of a book, like, and in the show, it kind of just ends with her traveling across the sea at the end of one season and then arriving at the other end at the beginning of another season, which is okay because that implies a time jump where no one else had a time jump, but whatever. It's interesting. It's interesting when you break the fantasy, you know, and somebody, and you, especially when you break the fantasy with, like, something that's a time restraint, because we're all tied to time, like, together, you know, it's like, it's different than emotions, you know, like, you can't argue with time, it's a number thing, and once you push time limits, that's cool, and once you're specifically on time, that's even better, you know what I mean? Like, if you've ever read a novel where's, like, you're getting to your climactic portion, and there's, like, a timer, and then, like, the way that you read is actually increased by the intensity of the scenario that's going on inside the text, and so with that, the timer then slows down within the text as well, And so it's like you get 5, and then this event, and then 4, and then this event, much faster, and then 3, and then this event, 2, this event, 1, this event, and then you get to your climactic moment. And it seems as if the counter was counting down, but honestly, it's just the author playing with your concept of time and the literacy of their vocabulary when they are writing so that they can entice you to read at the pace that they would like the timer to be counted at. And that's just brilliant, you know? Like, if you're in a romantic moment in a book, the writer might not use fast, spontaneous sentence structure to imply quick motion. They might make very long sentences and longer descriptive words because they want you to draw out that moment, make it feel more sensual, make the seconds feel longer, you know? Not a counter counting down to something, but getting lost in the distance where time should matter, you know? It's a very powerful tool using time, and if it's used well, it's used very well. You know, it intensifies any moment that it's placed in, be it stress or romance or grief or drama. It's good. Very good tool. It's just something that was on my mind and I wanted to do a talk about it. You know, somebody who plays with time really well is directors like Christopher Nolan, who play with the concept of time and the concept of stress with time and time limits. His movies like Interstellar and Inception, they use time very well. They don't say specifically within the boundaries of time, but they also let you know early on in those films with the story structure that time is something to be played with and not trusted throughout the entire viewing with both of those films, which is really nice, and it's a really nice, you know, Easter egg so that you can watch it at least twice. I love a lot a movie that tells me, hey, this is something that you're going to really appreciate when you watch it again, and when the director is able to nod to you and say, hey, I believe that my product is so good that you are going to view this a second time, and the second time that you watch it, because you enjoyed it that much and I trusted that you would enjoy it that much, I'm going to supplant this information here and this information here. A lot of it's going to be foreshadowing, but some more of it can also be supplanted because the director trusts themselves in their product and they're able to give you a little bit more polish on their product in a second viewing so that you can appreciate either a character's perspective even more that you didn't quite understand, and allows you to be engrossed by a fuller perspective of the story, or it could enhance a location's narrative, you know, because the first time that you're at the narrative location, you're not exposed to the location's total resources or population count. That makes me think right now of Mad Max Fury Road, where you are given more information about the Aquacola site, where it's got these massive structures of stone, and there's a warlord that has drilled, I guess, a well in one of these caverns in, deep into the earth, and he's discovered water, and he calls it Aquacola because it's after the nuclear apocalypse and most of the oceans have been destroyed, and people are starving for water and resources. Well, it starts off with him being placed with his war material on and walking past the pumps for the Aquacola water, and it's just a massive amount of water that you see him walking past because it's like gushing up and being stored. And he walks to these people that have been barely shown as very dirty and unwashed, and like they're all just walking through this desert to these giant stone like obelisks in the sky, and they're just carrying around these sheets of metal or cloth, just and carrying them above their heads, expecting something from above. So he releases the Aquacola to them, but then later in the movie, after events transpire and he starts to chase the protagonist, he runs through his giant obelisk of stone, and, well, it's giant boulders, actually. Like, it's not really stone, it's not built, they're, like, those things that you see in, like, the, Arizona desert and Utah desert. There's just those big natural obelisks. It was really cool. But yeah, he walks through it, to go discover the treasure that he's had stolen from him by the protagonists, and, you see that he walks past these plants that are being misted, and they're obviously like turnips, or they're like tomatoes, or, you know, just things that have a lot of vinage, and they're just in these rows, and there's hundreds of them, and you can remember back to the characters that were below in the beginning that were starving and very malnourished, and it's like, this guy has all of these resources that he's eating as a disposal because of water, and in the very beginning, you don't know about this, but by the middle of the movie, you're exposed to this, and then later on in the movie, towards, like, I believe, like, three quarters into the movie, you're exposed even further to, like, what is, like, mother's milk and things like that, which is a really disgusting resource, but it's, it has a justification for trade in that world, and on a second viewing, when you get to see all those people in the beginning and you see how malnourished they are, you can feel what they feel even more so towards this warlord figure, like, this kind of, like, worship toward him, because he has all these resources that he could, if he wanted to, give to you, and there might be some kind of animosity towards him. And by the end of the first viewing, the warlord is dead, and, spoiler, but the people end up tearing his body to pieces. And if you don't pay attention all the way through the first time, and you're not completely absorbing the information about the resources and stuff that get exposed to you, by the end, when they tear his body apart, you might not feel the animosity that they have toward him, because they have to worship him like this godlike figure. But by the end, if you're feeling the right emotions and you're taking in the right information, you know that he has abused that kind of power. He is a twisted figure of a deity. And it's in his name. His name is Immortan Joe. And it's like a mortal. It's a twisted version, like a mutated, irradiated word of immortal, Immortan. And then the last name being Joe, just an average Joe, you know? And I really appreciate that nameage, because he's a Immortan Joe. He's a mutated average Joe that is just abused his power, and he's claimed deityship. And you see his full cycle by the end of that movie, and then on second viewing, because the creator, George Romero, trusted himself with his product, he gets to plant these other little Easter eggs and these details, like traveling through the crow's land in the film. There's this irradiated land, and when the protagonists get to their destination, and the protagonist asks one of the people she's been looking for, where's our land? It's revealed her climax, which I don't want to give away because it's very good. But that crow's land, if you've listened to what I was just saying, it's heavily implied toward her climax, and it's heartbreaking, you know, because you see this thing planted early, and then it's paid off 20 minutes later, and then on the second viewing, you can immediately start to feel that pain as you approach that area, because you know what it's tied to. Hopefully I didn't give too much away, and if you haven't seen it, then that's good. I mean, I did give away the antagonist's death, so kind of already in spoiler territory with that. But yeah, timing is really important in movies, and it's just something I really enjoy when it's done correctly, because you can really just piece it out. One thing that I really enjoyed that I just recently watched was Hacksaw Ridge. And timing is used pretty good in that. It's not the greatest paced movie. They spend about, I want to say, the first hour getting you attached to this character and his religious beliefs and his personal beliefs. They play it in a lot of flashbacks, though, to reveal, like, these damaging moments when they matter because they're brought back up in his life. And I would just rather you just play me it in order. Because, like I said, with timing, you're breaking my timing with that. When you do a lot of flashbacks, that's why I said it plays timing pretty good, is in the first hour, it's getting you attached to these characters, and then in the second hour, it is raw Saving Private Ryan action, which is great. And it's from a medic's perspective, so it's like, you're not shoot, get all the glory, get all the gore. It's watch my buddy shoot, and get all the glory, but I'm pulling him aside to make sure he doesn't get shot when they shoot back, so I don't have to patch him up. Or watch my buddy with blown off legs as I tie something around his no longer legs, so that he stops gushing blood, give him morphine, get him dragged out of the way, and quick shot to my friend who's killed apparently three of the enemy and is getting all these glory kills, but we're not filming that totally because it's not his movie. It's a medic's movie. And so that's where I really enjoy that, because the intensity and the pacing in that second part of the movie is exactly what I would expect out of the timing that's going through the head of this person who isn't there to take a life. He's there to save one. So I really like the timing in that aspect. But to give the negative aspect, not to call this a negative movie, because it's fantastic, it's a great movie, but in using flashbacks to deliver dramatic moments, it's just, I don't like it. I prefer a film that would give me details that I don't understand or that I don't know why they are in that place, and then have them pay off when they need to pay off if I paid attention later in the road. Don't tell me a film that's out of order unless you've told me in the beginning that time should not be trusted, and the reason it should not be trusted is because it's a part of the narrative and part of the story structure on purpose. Don't tell me a story out of order for dramatic effect. That's lazy. That's very lazy. If I'm reading a novel, that's different, though, because a flashback in a novel, you don't want a biography of every character. That's kind of terrible, and no character, no person thinks in a biographical thought process. We all have thoughts about different parts of our lives randomly, you know, and different events that happen in our lives are going to trigger different memories for us, and I get that that's kind of like a flashback, but if I'm watching the narratives of someone on a film, I'm watching their story from beginning to end. I'm not watching their story from beginning to memory of the past to the current moment again and then to the end. Like, I just don't like that. You're breaking my story apart. Give me Back to the Future. Back to the Future does not flashback. It does not do that. Why? Because I believe it's Robert Zemeckis that directed that one. He trusted his film. He trusted his direction. He knew that he was going from beginning to middle to end, and if you look at the arc structure of all three of those films, they are made to be one massive epic, which is great. You get your character's highest of highs, or your character introductions, your solid introductions in the entire first movie of who's going to be important in your entire cast, which is great because you don't quite realize that all of the main characters of the series in Back to the Future are broken up into side characters and villains in the first film. So in the first film, you have Marty and Doc, and Marty's mom and dad, and then you also have Biff, and you have Marty's girlfriend. Marty's girlfriend is kind of a B-list character the entire time, but she really honestly has quite a bit of a shine. in the second film, because she's married to Marty, and she gets to have an argument with him, with the children, and then about him being fired, and with his mom. That's actually quite good. And she really shines as a character there. But she is not in the last movie at all, really, I don't think. Except for the very end with the train. I think that's it with her there. So with that, all of your characters that are your main characters are broken up into side characters and villains in the first film. And that's really cool with character structure, because then with the second film, instead of going bigger and bolder and a completely, like, blown out story, they actually had a story structure. So they took the characters that were the side characters and villains from the first film and made them the main characters, specifically in the second film, when they went into the future and they introduced more new side characters and sub-villains so that they could play off of and give new dialogue to play with the main, now new main character. So Marty wasn't just the main protagonist. Now we had a cast of people that we now know and care about that are coming back, which is great. And then at the end, in the final chapter, because this is one great epic, you can remove quite a few characters, so that since you took the first film and then you doubled the cast in the second film, now what you do in the third film is you totally remove Marty's mom and dad. Like, I believe, like, they're not in that third film, because he goes into the past, you know, they're not there. And I believe that Michael J. Fox, he played two characters in that one. He played his great-great-great-grandpa, and he played himself, which is kind of great, to use that word one more time. But they cut their cast, I believe, in half. If not more, from the second film, so that they can tell a more core story and pull the story to a close. So you have your first one, which is your character introductions, your second movie, which has your character's highest of highs and lowest of lows, and you have a giant cast of characters so that you can really blow up that world and, like, make it feel lived in, and then your third story pulls it all in and closes it out. And that's honestly the way that trilogy should be done. I think that Star Wars should have been done that way. I've been talking for 22 minutes. That's great. But I'm going to end with the Star Wars thing. With story structure. Because... and timing. Because that's what I think this new trilogy really lacked was... if you look at the original trilogy and even the second film... they do the same thing as Back to the Future, you know? They do introductory characters in the first film with, like, Luke, Han, and Leia. And, you know, Han's a side character in that one. Leia's a side character. Luke is the main character. You also have Obi-Wan, Ed Vader as the villain. And then in the second one, you expand that. And now you have Vader as the main villain, because he has his own storyline, and you have the Emperor as Vader's villain that he has to deal with, and he has to figure out if he's going to follow or if he's going to flip or something, because he is now his own character. In the second film, Empire, the reason why I believe a lot of people enjoy that film is because the first film is an introductory film. It follows a great structure. It's one story broken into three movies, which is, you know, the hero's journey. But I believe the hero's journey goes beyond a single character in the second film, because you are able to introduce your hero's journey with your main character in the first film. And if you're playing your story right, you then take your second film and you continue the hero's journey with your side characters. Because your main character can be halfway through their hero's journey in the second movie, and your side characters can now have realized their hero's journey by the end of the first film. So you're introduced to them. You don't have to care about them in the first film. like, you don't have to care about Doc in the first film very much. He's introduced in the beginning, killed, then he's reintroduced in the middle, and he's there to be Marty's goal, you know, he gets him back to the future. That's funny, because the name. But he's not there as a main character. But by the third movie, everybody is reduced except for Doc. Why? Because his hero's journey started at the end of the first film. He is a side character, but he's a cemented friend of our main protagonist. So, we care enough about Doc by the end of the first film that we want to know what happens to him. We want to know what happens to Marty's mom and dad by the end of the first film, because those side characters, we've invested enough time with our main character. Our main character went and did stuff with these people, so we can't help but care about these people, because our main character had to care about these people. You know what I mean? We've been through it with them. Like, it's like hanging out with people that you don't really care about, because your friend is friends with them, but over time, you keep hanging out with those people, that person that isn't your friend, but is friends of your friend, but they keep hanging out, so you go over to their place. You eventually start caring about that person. You don't mean to, but you start paying attention to what they say. You start actually taking in their opinion sometimes. You know, it happens in nature. So in a story, if you use that and you utilize that story and you start your hero's journey with your side characters, like Han Solo's hero's journey. A lot of people say it begins in The New Hope. But doesn't. I don't believe it does. I believe he's a smuggler through and through to the end of that film. Why? Because he has one spark that starts his hero's journey at the end when he comes back to save Luke. For 80% of that movie, he is a smuggler looking for the end of a job. And that's true. But when he chooses to go back and save Luke, that's his spark of his hero's journey, and that's the reason I believe that Leia fell in love with him. And so that's why she's holding his pendant of the medal that he won, like, in the end of the episode 4. She's holding that when she dies, and then is given to Chewie, because that is their tie to his hero's journey moment. You know what I mean? Like, he is a smuggler, and then he becomes a rebel and a good man, which is great. And it's a great way to play your hero's journey. Now, explaining across three movies, of course, like, you can do a brilliant epic across three good stories. We can also do it in one story, you know. You just gotta blow up your middle and then reduce your characters towards the end and give them justified exits off of a smaller hero's journey, you know. Like, you introduce your characters in the very beginning, you have your main character do a couple of acts of investment. So if you've invested with those characters, with that little bit of time frame, and then you have those characters re-arise if they need to be in the main character story again, you have them re-arise, you solve something for them that feels cathartic, and then you have them exit, giving the hero something to move along, which is great, because then you have a reason for them to be there, you have a reason for them to leave, and you feel catharsis the entire way, because you know that your friend isn't gone, but they were there to hang out for the reason they were going to hang out, you know? It's like when a buddy hits you up and is like, hey, you down to hang out for a couple hours? I got time to kill. They show up, 10 minutes later, you play a couple video games, you talk, you bullshit, you vent a little bit with each other. They say, hey, I'm going to head out, and they leave, and it's much better than your friend saying, hey, you want to hang out? They come over, you're hanging out, you're venting, you're playing video games, and then they pause the video game, they get up, and they leave. Well, you don't have catharsis. Your friend just did. Were you boring? Did you say something wrong? Did you offend them? So I feel like that's the same kind of feeling that we get in a movie when a character is introduced, has no purpose to be there, so, like, it's your friend just showing up, and then sitting down, grabbing a controller, and being like, we're playing video games, right? So if your character isn't introduced for a reason, what are they doing there? That's the question that I think you get in a story, as in real life. And then two, if they leave without catharsis or explanation, you don't get a good feeling off of that. I wouldn't get a good feeling off of that. That would hurt. So you need a proper exit for each one of your characters that you introduce. Yeah, I'm going to leave it with that. I said I was going to leave it with Star Wars. But yeah, story structure is important. Time is very important. Thank you for listening to Talk the Talk. I definitely can talk the talk, I guess. I'll hear from you guys again. Have a good one.